how the industry, in my view, is changes, we are far more interconnected. Everyone has got a first cloud-first approach, and therefore we are all making use of certain services and partners that, if impacted by an event, will impact, and the blast range will change, and therefore all of us are impacted.
Hello and welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm Alice.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues with Mimecast. Every episode we'll be joined by a special visitor or visitors who are definitely not your average guest to share tales of risk, reward, and sometimes ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity, to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe.
Okay, Alice, pop quiz time. When do you think the very first pair of Dr. Martens shoes were made?
Oh, well, I know they were huge in the 80s and 90s, so I'm going to guess maybe sometime in the 70s.
You're a couple of decades out. Try 1945. The story goes that Dr. Klaus Martens, a 25-year-old soldier, was nursing a broken foot, and he created a unique air cushion sole just to kind of aid in his recovery. And he showed the prototype to an old university friend, someone called Dr. Herbert Funk. And by 1947, they began formal production, and within a decade had a booming business.
Wow, that's incredible. What an historic brand. And that makes me even more excited to have Theo Buerta on the podcast today. Theo is the Global Information Security Officer at Dr. Martens, which makes him responsible for protecting one of the most iconic brands across the world.
Welcome, Theo. It's great to have you with us today.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So Theo, we always like to start by simplifying things a little and asking our guests how they would introduce themselves if they were at, say, a dinner party.
That's quite interesting. I normally don't bring in what I do, so I just sort of introduce myself, and based on accent, I'm normally asked where I'm from, and then it's sport discussions. But if I'm asked what I'm doing, then it's play in cybersecurity, and then the conversation certainly flows. And when they want to know where I'm working, then Dr. Martens is certainly a talking point.
Absolutely, I can imagine. And would you be able to give our listeners a bit of insight into how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. I started a career in sort of physical security. So, physically stopping individuals going into premises. And then the same organization I operated in and worked in, sort of moved into a more technology-based approach, and I've been studying and at that point technology for quite a few years, and put my hand up and said I'll lead that technology change for them, and that started my 20-plus year career in all areas of technology, from designing websites, coding, running cables through buildings, and then I did that for a couple of years, all levels, managing teams. And then one of the organizations I worked in needed to go into a more structured, certified environment for information security. And as it happens, they put that on the desk of the IT guy, and I put my hand up and said, yeah, I'll try and get an ISO 27001 or Cyber Essentials certification for the organization, which we achieved, and fell into information security risk management.
It's very interesting actually to hear that. I think a number of our guests that we've had on the podcast have also gone from the physical security and then come across into the technical and the cybersecurity side. And we'd love to understand a bit more around, how would you describe what your current role to date with Dr. Martens entails?
Yeah, so the core element of my role is to ensure that I build cybersecurity strategy in line with Dr. Martens' DOC strategy. So very key for the cyber strategy not to slow down the business. So understanding the real context of risk, and also the board's risk appetite. And then based on that, deliver a strategy that speeds up security maturity, but also ensure the business thrives. So I do that by splitting the services and strategy across general risk and compliance, security engineering, security architecture, and security operations. So strong teams within that space, which I've built over the last sort of 3.5 years at Dr. Martens. And just making sure that those teams have what they need from a day-to-day basis, right partnerships to support them, and then ultimately for us to deliver our cyber strategy and support the business. So, yeah, and in a nutshell, understand the right level of risk, and then ensuring the business and board understands that risk and can make the right decisions.
Well, you've actually raised a huge bunch of very, very interesting things, which I'd love to get into some of those things. I think maybe as a starting point, you worked in cybersecurity at multiple different organizations over the years. How would you characterize how the cyber threat landscape has changed? And particularly maybe with an eye to how you would describe that maybe to, say, a board or someone like that. How do you describe how the landscape has changed, and how do you kind of get everybody to understand the risks? I love the fact that you've got a risk kind of mindset to a lot of things.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's a business risk and making sure that they understand that risk sits with business. I'm there to implement the strategy to support their view of business risk and their appetite to accept the cyber risk. So what would be an acceptable level of risk and therefore events or incidents coming your way? And that's normally a question I'll raise to the board or a new board once I meet them. Ultimately, the message is always that you will have an incident and therefore what are we putting in place to understand what's coming our way, monitoring what's coming our way so we can manage ourselves out of the incident successfully. And I think how the industry, in my view, has changed is we are far more interconnected. Everyone has got a first cloud first approach, and therefore we are all making use of certain services and partners that, if impacted by an event, will impact and the blast range will change, and therefore all of us are impacted. You know, if an AWS zone goes down and our services are sitting in there. I think that's definitely the change for the last 10 to 15 years with regards to the technology change and also the attacks as a service that we have through our attackers. You know, they don't have to technically do a lot to affect quite a lot of businesses, because we are so interconnected. And I think that's the big change for us. And therefore the message to the board is, we're playing in this space, we're making use of all of these services. We are gonna have an event, we are gonna have an incident. And therefore the risk is there, and how do we manage ourselves out of it successfully?
I understand that you joined Dr. Martens just as the world was heading into lockdown in 2020, which, God, talk about being thrown in at the deep end. Would you be able to talk us through maybe some of that experience and navigating that change within the business, especially joining so fresh and so new at that time, and maybe some of your observations?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was certainly an uncertain time for the world. But I think Dr. Martens was pretty much set up to manage the pandemic as the rules changed from three different regions. So we operate globally in Americas, APAC and EMEA. And obviously we could see how it hit APAC and the rules there, and sort of model what's going to happen in EMEA and the US. So we were pretty much, you know, well set up there from a board perspective and how they managed that strategy. And then as we were closing down showrooms and retail units, the e-com platform was ready for the influx and sales there. So technically and strategically set up. But for me personally, you know, I had a strategy as I walked in. I met with the CTO during my notice period 3 months before, and we had, you know, a plan to build a team, build a service, and I had to rip that up within the first sort of 2 weeks. And the focus really was bringing security to the end user that now suddenly is dispersed and working from home and in a remote location. The Dr. Martens architecture, like most organizations, was sort of old school behind the firewall architecture. So changing that very quickly and then putting security around it. But I think ultimately is bringing in the pandemic strategy back to fundamentals. So the four areas I focused on was monitoring of the end user, the vulnerability management of the end user, endpoint security, absolutely, and identity management. That was the four items that I just focused on and changed my strategy. Once those were in place and I knew the end user was secure and aware of their new working environment, I was able to go back to the traditional strategy and continue improving maturity.
Okay, that's interesting, because I think it was a very difficult time. I mean, it was a difficult time for businesses in general, but I think particularly for the retail sector, What were some of the lessons from, and I'm going to sort of kind of do a bit of a layered question. So maybe a question in two or maybe even three parts. But I think firstly, what are the lessons from a cybersecurity perspective that maybe you learned from the pandemic? And then secondly, maybe from a cybersecurity leadership perspective, because I love the fact that you say the fundamentals stayed the same, but you've still got to communicate that with your team. You've still got to inspire them. You've still got to connect them with the why and explain the changing circumstances and keep everybody on board. Because I think it was a very, very challenging time psychologically for a lot of people.
I think it was just going back to the basics, the fundamentals. I think some organizations might have been caught out if they didn't have those in place. So it didn't matter what your strategy was. If you didn't have the fundamentals in place under a pandemic, that will be absolutely exposed. I think within Dr. Martin's, we had those in place and we just enhanced those to focus on end user security. So that probably was the biggest learning curve for me was ultimately you thought, pandemic, massive lockdown, how do I change my strategy? But I actually realized I didn't have to change much. It was just flipping it on its head and focusing on end user security with those fundamental components in place. And how are they working from home? Do they have everything they need to work from home? And therefore, what's the security around that? The awareness piece was the biggest piece. So for example, I did a lot of lunch and learns in my initial stages of my role across the business, meeting everyone I could meet just to give them an explanation of what it is I'm here to do and how I'm going to do it under a pandemic, just so that there's a level of an awareness of what's coming their way. And I think that just calms everything down, calms business down, and ultimately the board as well. Meeting the board, they were key to understand what it is we are going to do now that we're under a pandemic, and it's just explaining the fundamentals.
And I can imagine being such a global and iconic brand that looking to protect that brand must come with additional pressure because you're so well known. I'd love to understand a bit around how do you look to protect that brand as much as you can from a cyber space? If we were to look at, say, your previous physical security career, you may be aware of who your targeter is, but in the cyberspace, we don't necessarily know who those people are, and these attacks could be coming from any angle. Is that something you've seen, and how do you look to combat that?
Yeah, absolutely. The brand is a great brand, and as our CEO always says, instills in us, we're the custodians of a great brand, and with that comes responsibility. And you try not to dwell on it too much, otherwise you're not going to sleep at night. But also, that's the level of you're proud to work for this brand, and therefore you're doing everything you can within your team to protect that brand. From a cybersecurity perspective, we are a strong brand. We're a very positive brand. And with that, people take advantage of, copying websites and trying to catch our customers. And therefore, from a brand exploit protection, we have services in place across multiple partners that gives us that visibility and therefore the monitoring, so we can see what's coming our way and where these fake elements are being created. And then internally, we work very closely with our legal IP team. So we provide the technical output of what's happening, what's going on out there. They take that, do an analysis, and then make a legal decision before we, take down a fake site, as an example.
Have you found there's been any interesting techniques you've been able to use to, say, raise that awareness for your employees and also for your end customers, as well as being careful around these threats?
Yeah, I think our customers are certainly aware of our brand and therefore what's real and what's not, because they're so invested in the brand. So that's certainly an easier element to tackle. Our teams in our showrooms and retail units, absolutely, they're part of our training and awareness program. We've got various channels where we push out our awareness piece, and within my team we have some awareness experts that push it out across three regions, 11 different languages, different cultures, making sure that it lands in that culture as well and is effective. And it's all about behavioral change. So rather than 45 minutes of cybersecurity training, it is small nudges on a monthly basis that just provides a bit of an awareness that you're moving your cursor and clicking on a external domain. Yeah, are you sure that is a valid domain? Just sort of nudges to ensure that it changes behaviors, and then obviously doing some simulation training and so on at C level down to employee level as well. And then all of the results get published. We're not naming and shaming, but people are aware of the percentages of the training taking place across all regions. And I think it just makes people a bit more aware. They're part of the design of the content as well. So we have pilot groups as an example. So they're part of the design of awareness, and then through that they're learning. And for me, ultimately, is bringing that cybersecurity knowledge into their personal life, you know, so that they can take it into how they do banking, as an example, or how they manage their own personal email. And once you do that, it's much easier for them to operate in that way in a business environment.
So I'm curious to know what your views are on, and I like the fact you say you don't name and shame them. The industry seems quite split. You have some organizations where you kind of have a three strikes and you're fired kind of mindset. You have other organizations that are almost too scared of their users even to send them phishing attacks, in case it upsets the users. Where do you think that fine line is?
Yeah, I've been in organizations where sending out a phishing simulation caused havoc and a lot of challenges and was never done again within that organization. I think the culture within Dr. Martens is about learning, is about understanding, and therefore the board is behind it, as part of the test as well, including our non-executive directors. Everyone's part of the simulation test and quite keen to see what's the percentage. And I think because it comes from senior level in that way, it's much easier than to deliver that and all other levels. What's the fine line? I think you do not want to piss off people. and those are the individuals that are working on a day-to-day basis with your data, with your technology. And therefore, I'm not a fan of naming and shaming in any way. I don't think that's helpful. I think providing extra awareness and training for that individual afterwards, absolutely. But no one needs to know about it. People know the percentage. They don't know who's in it. We obviously know who's in it, who's the names. But, you know, that's just the database. And I think I've been in organizations where there was naming and shaming. It just never landed well because we all make mistakes. You know, we all click on a link. We all send the wrong email to the wrong distribution list. Let's learn from it rather than naming and shaming.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And that's certainly the sort of recommendation advice that we give, but obviously different organizations are different. Something you mentioned earlier on, and I'd like to kind of just dig into a little bit, you know, if you look at your supply chain, and you mentioned earlier that sort of supply chain attacks are becoming a huge problem, particularly because of the sort of almost systemic risk now that everybody's using similar cloud platforms and things. How do you manage these risks within your own supply chain in the retail space?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of having a very strong vendor onboarding process, and it's a cross functional process. So ensuring that your privacy team is involved, the financial checks is involved, a compliance team is involved, legal team is involved, and then obviously from a cybersecurity perspective, my team's involved and managing the whole process and closing that loop. So what it does is it gives us a very clear indication of the security maturity of that partner before they're onboarded. And the level of risk per partner will obviously change. If we're onboarding a partner that's gonna deliver a piece of technology or touch our data, therefore the scrutiny and the questions going their way will be different, and the level of certification we want from them would be different. So it's just having the right level of security and scrutiny from one partner to the other, but ultimately a process that connects all of those cross-functional services to ensure that we understand the level of risk coming our way, continue monitoring of that. I think that's the key bit for us to understand that third-party supply management piece.
And Theo, you mentioned around how the Dr. Martens kind of board and executive team are incredibly supportive and potentially one of the most supportive teams that you've had the pleasure of working with. I know that some, say, leaders in similar positions to you have mentioned that they've often struggled to gain buy-in or to gain a seat at the table or to gain that sense of seriousness around what they're talking about and being involved in the required discussions. For maybe those people who are struggling, what advice would you give them around gaining that buy-in from, say, the board and the executive level? And maybe what messaging have you found has landed particularly well?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, I'm not saying I've not had challenges in any role I've been in. There's certainly, certain stakeholders that's not always on board from day one, and you identify them very quickly, and you you know, you put your this arm around the shoulder approach and see their viewpoint and understand and meet them in the middle and have a conversation, I think is very important. What in my experience don't land really well is just raising red flags and risks. But it's more of a, yeah, we have this risk, but this is where I can meet you halfway. So that they ultimately achieve what they need to achieve within their daily role. And you sort of meet in the middle to get a level of risk understanding and potentially maturity and security, rather than, you know, I need to have the gold-plated standard in place. Otherwise, we have all of these risks. So I think it's understanding the context of risks, understanding the individual's role, respect their role within the business. They're there to do a specific role and deliver a service. And how can you help them land their strategy in a secure way?
And I can imagine, as you say, you mentioned earlier around, you know, you haven't been without challenges in your career, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners are also empathizing with. Would you maybe be able to share with us maybe some of the larger challenges that you've experienced and how have you looked to overcome those?
I think the biggest thing is getting senior board engagement. I think that's ultimately in my role, that's the biggest challenge, and that's your role, is making sure that you understand the business risk, you understand the business strategy, and therefore align your cyber strategy to business objectives. That's key. You don't want to slow down the business operating and making money. We're not selling cybersecurity, you know, we're selling a product and a brand. For me, obviously having security incidents or events, and I've had those in various roles in the past, that ultimately increases your stress level. Even with the best incident response process in place, there are still those incidents that sort of blindside you, and through analysis, you still don't know where it's coming from, and that could be quite challenging. And there, it's how you as a leader react so that your team stay calm, but also ultimately you're the buffer between team and board, and how they stay calm.
And I think it's a common refrain that we actually hear from guests we've had on the podcast, is a lot of sort of security leaders come from a very technical background, and I think it's a necessary ingredient in being a good security leader. But the sort of piece that's lacking is that stakeholder management, business communication side of things. Where did you kind of learn that? Did you kind of go, is that just sort of learning by doing experience, or did you very specifically go out and acquire those kinds of skills?
I think it's a combination of just learning and getting burnt, getting, you know, the reaction you didn't want from a board, and then adjusting. But also, you know, I've put myself through external coaching quite a lot, and I think that's important. So you're not just training yourself from a cyber and technology perspective, understanding risk and information security, you know, you actually developing yourself as a person, how you communicate, and how do you get your agenda across? Always ask for feedback, you know, how could I have done better there, positive or negative, and then adjusting.
And with the kind of ever-evolving landscape, I know, and you mentioned it earlier around making sure that you also have the relevant people in place to support you with, essentially, as that landscape chops and changes and you have different requirements. But I think we're very aware that there's a very large skills shortage at the moment in the security industry. What have you found has been the impact of that on, say, existing security practitioners?
Certainly a positive impact from making a move from one role to another. The negative side is if you look at job descriptions, it's always asking for some sort of unicorn and, you know, well-rounded all-rounder that can do everything. And I think that the negative impact there is that you have individuals obviously looking at the job description, you know, I can do, let's say, 4 out of 10 things and therefore not going to apply. And then you're losing candidates that, you know, through development and through transferable skills could actually do the role quite well. And I think that's the issue, I think, within industry, is because there's such a shortage of individuals, it's let's try and get that individual can do everything, and there's no one else like that. I think that's the challenge.
And how do you find that has an impact on, say, you know, also the mental health side for those people? I can imagine, you know, if somebody is looking to bring in a unicorn, for example, a master of everything, which I think we all know is not achievable, but also then having the added pressure of knowing that you are potentially being targeted at any time from any angle. Have you found that that's had a large mental health impact on employees as well?
I think that's where the relationship with board, the understanding of risk, the message around incidents will happen, events will take place. So let me go and do what I need to do and let my team do what they need to do during an incident or outside of an incident. That's where, as a CISO type role, you're the buffer between business and your team so that they can just get on with what they need to be doing. I always tell my team that I'm the one that's supposed to be worried and not sleeping, not them. They're the experts in their field, and therefore just go and do what you do and do it well. And there's no blame culture. We all make mistakes. And I think if that's not the message, then it's quite a challenging environment to operate in. And so I don't think it's an industry thing. I think it's how you as a leader take that on and support your team being that buffer between board.
And what would maybe be your advice to somebody looking to enter into the cybersecurity field at the moment?
As I always say to various individuals that reach out to me, it's just apply. Job descriptions will have that 10, 15 items that they want you to deliver all the time, every day. But honestly, there's no one out there at that level. And therefore, even if you can just do 3 or 4 of those items, if you can show transferable skills in 5 others, just apply. For me, it's all about attitude.
And then Theo, I mean, I think it's something that we've all experienced. There's a lot of chatter about it on various social media channels, LinkedIn being one good example. What is your biggest frustration with cybersecurity vendors in general? And what would your advice be to those cybersecurity vendors in terms of marketing to security leaders and just getting their message across in a way that wasn't kind of selling fear and wasn't ambulance chasing and all of the kind of things that seems to be so troubling?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're as you just said, fear and ambulance chasing is just doesn't land well, not with me. And that's in the same way I don't operate with my board. And therefore, any vendor approaching me, what I do appreciate is when they, let's use email security as an example. If it's a new piece of technology or partnership, articulate what differentiates your product from what is out there in the market already. And I'm sometimes quite clear and sharing what we use right now as an example. So what's the difference between that product and what I'm using right now? And if there's no synergy and no way of working right now, that's fine. Let's keep the communication open. Not another 10, 15 emails after, trying to get that call in when it's not a focus right now. I think listen to the response and react in that way. I've got various partners that email me in a year later, touch base again, and then it's the right opportunity in the right moment and we become partnerships or we sign up the partnership.
Maybe Theo, one final question from us. I can see some shoe boxes in the back. Yes. So we wanted to maybe ask a little bit of a fun question. If any, how many pairs of Dr. Martens do you own?
I think about 13 pairs now.
Wow.
the ones on display is it's just great brand, great product, and they look really cool, but I'm not cool enough to wear them, so they're just for display only. And then I have about 10 pairs that I you wear around always in the office. Obviously any event I'm wearing another pair. The first thing people look at when they meet me is my feet. And therefore I ensure I have either, the latest on, as it's always a good conversation maker anyway. So yeah, about 13 pairs right now.
Yeah, I can imagine you're very proud to represent the brand.
So Theo, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I think this was really interesting and really fun. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests 3 simple questions.
So Theo, maybe looking back over your career, what would be, say, the one insight that you'd wish you'd learnt sooner or that you could go back and tell your younger self?
Yeah, I think it's just having that confidence just to make that next move. We just discussed various roles going out there, and then you read through it and you're like, oh yeah, I'm not good enough to apply for it. That imposter syndrome. Certainly I've suffered from it through my career and I still do. And I think it's ignoring that and just apply, go for it, take the risk. And I honestly wish I took the risk more than 13 years ago and made the change into cybersecurity. Absolutely.
I think that's a great answer. And I'm looking forward to your next one. And we've had some very interesting ones, so don't feel any pressure. They've ranged from children's stories all the way through to some sort of very deep philosophical books, so, and everything in between. But what are you reading or listening to at the moment? And is there anything that you'd recommend to our listeners?
I still like reading physical books. So I've got a couple of books. Jordan Peterson, 12 More Rules of Life. I'm going to make my way through that. Yomi Park. I finished her current book first book, In Order to Live. So, you know, the move from North Korea into where she is now. And then current book, which is While Time Remains, I think. So now that she's settled in the US and how she sees life.
And so, Theo, maybe looking towards the future, say this time next year, what trends do you think we might be spotting?
I think there's certainly going to be, and I hate going on what everyone's saying, but I think the impact of by AI and generative AI on the fundamentals of security. So has it changed the way in which ransomware attacks take place, as an example, or gets past detection, as an example? And also the positives, you know, how has it sped up sort of mundane, repetitive roles and tasks that we have in our own jobs, you know, replying to emails, as an example. I think that in a year's time, and even before that, it's going to be an interesting topic, I think, from a security perspective. So I think in a year's time, it's going to be quite interesting world. What's real? What's fake online? I think that's sort of the trends I'm sort of seeing.
Well, thank you so much, Theo, for joining us today. And thank you also to all of our listeners for joining us on this week's Fishy Business. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. If you have enjoyed our podcast today, please do leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free to follow us on our LinkedIn page @Mimecast if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed. Until next time.